It is that time again, my favourite 20 VC of the month with The Memo, the show where we deep dive into one specific investment with the investor that led the deal at that firm. The last few, from DoorDash to Snap to Pinterest, have all been consumer, and so I thought we should mix it up today and enter the world of SaaS. And what better company to cover than the incredible Twilio journey, and who better to have me on the show for that journey than the master of SaaS himself, Byron Deeter, one of the world's leading investors in SaaS and cloud. I mean, this man has more unicorns than I've done podcasts, with 19 of Byron's investments valued at over $1 billion, including 10 IPOs and counting. To name a few of the investments, Twilio, which we focus on today, Service Titan, HashiCorp, Canva, Intercom, DocuSign, SendGrid, the list goes on. And prior to joining the world of venture, Byron was an entrepreneur, raising a Series A from Bessemer and scaling the company to be one of the first global SaaS companies, reaching profitability and selling to IBM. I'd also want to say a huge thank you to Scott Rainey, Albert Wenger, Jeremy Levine, and Matt Garrett for some amazing questions suggestions today. I really did so appreciate that. But before we move into the show today, question, why can you not invest in sports cards like you can stocks? Well, with Alt, you can. Alt is increasing the transparency and liquidity of alternative assets, allowing you to invest from as little as $7 to $1 million on their exchange. And with Alt, you also save on fees. There's only a 1.5% transaction fee, and they also have this incredible real-time valuation engine. And so you can see what your portfolio is worth in real time. That and so much more. Check them out at onlyalt.com. That's onlyalt.com. And speaking of adding superpowers to your financials, you have to check out Revolut Business. Revolut Business is a financial super app for all things business. It's super easy, powerful, and personalized accounts. Gives you control over all your business finances and processes in one place. I'm a proud Revolut Business user myself. So why do I love it so much? Well, joining Revolut Business lets you send and receive money at the interbank rate, no hidden fees, as well as opening accounts in more than 28 currencies. Just incredible. But what I like the most is that you can actually streamline your business processes by integrating all your apps or plugins, like accounting and expenses, and manage it from one place. Basically, you get more control over your day-to-day business finances, processes, and management, which means you can really focus on your actual business goals. I've partnered with Revolut Business to bring you guys an exclusive 2-month paid plan for free, so you can move forward with your business without worrying about your banking provider. Go to revolut.com/20VC to claim your free 2-month trial and get started. But last but by no means least, you might have heard Pilot in the news recently. They just raised $100 million Series C from Sequoia, Bezos Expeditions, and Whale Rock, putting them at a $1.2 billion valuation. Why the buzz? Well, Pilot takes care of your startup's finances for you, from bookkeeping to tax to R&D credits and more. When you work with them, you're paired with a finance expert who's a full-time employee in San Francisco or Nashville who really knows your business from the ground up. Pilot's team works in QuickBooks and NetSuite with software superpowers to help check the work. They've grown with over 1,000 startups like Scale.ai, Lattice, and OpenAI, and no one can help you scale like they can. If you want to let Pilot focus on your financials so you can focus on growing your business, go to pilot.com/20VC and get 20% off the first 6 months of core or select bookkeeping plans. That's pilot.com/20VC.
But I'm so excited for this. It's now time for The Memo. It's now time for Byron Deeter and what an incredible journey that he's going to unveil with the Twilio journey.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Byron, this is such a joy to do. I've wanted to do this one for a very, very long time now. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Harry, great to be back with my favorite self-made British VC, baby.
You are too kind. God, I'm going to love this show. But I want to focus today on Twilio. It's been such an incredible journey. So we're going to go back to the beginning. It's 2009. Paint the picture. How did you meet the team? Where was the meeting? And how did that 2009 deal come about, Byron?
So this is a true story of teamwork, where David Callen, Ethan Kurzweil, and myself have been chasing them and involved with them for years. The initial investment started with David Callen leading a $125,000 seed investment as part of this seed extension round that Mitch Kapoor led. And Ethan Kurzweil, who's now one of our great partners, was a senior associate at the time. And Ethan slid a check over a breakfast table with Jeff for $125,000 at a diner in SF that then started this relationship that ultimately became best Bessemer's largest investment in terms of total dollars, and fortunately also in terms of returns, but largest total dollars over multiple rounds, and this awesome journey of Jeff and his brilliance and this crazy vision that he had early on.
I mean, you mentioned Jeff and his brilliance. You mentioned kind of the continuing concentration of capital there into Twilio. We're going to touch on both of those. I do want to start on the market, though. Way back in 2009, you know, I spoke to many people on the cap table pre this show, and they said just how many people actually had passed on the opportunity, being concerned largely about the size of the market for voice apps. So Scott Rainey at Redpoint specifically asked this one, so I can take no credit, but he said, what did you see that you think many others didn't about the market at the time?
So it's interesting in that we didn't have market size concerns. We had kind of market quality and segmentation concerns. Meaning, if you step back and think about communications, it's one of these immense multi-hundred-billion-dollar TAMs. Literally, it's one of the largest markets, you know, known to technology. The issue is, how is it possibly addressable? And this idea of voice apps was essentially a $0 billion market at the time. And so you had this logical disconnect of, did a platform layer deserve to exist there? Why hadn't the telephony providers done this? Why wasn't Skype or Google Voice offering APIs and doing this? And did a third party deserve to exist? And that was the leap of faith that we made here. And to that end, absolutely, there is this fear of, if you build it, will they come? And I'll readily confess, the early data wasn't super encouraging. When we made the investment, not only was the revenue tiny, but it was actually down month over month. And so this was one of those where you step back and say, okay, are we jumping in this pool? Do we believe? And fortunately, through some combination of a little bit of good strategy and a lot of good luck, we got conviction, but it definitely was not obvious at the time, and there were not a lot of precedents. You didn't have API-based businesses at large scale. Even AWS was still in the infancy, and so there weren't a lot of comps or examples to point to here.
Okay, you mentioned the revenue actually not being up, but also being kind of down in certain cases, and you also mentioned telephony not kind of adopting it or like embracing it themselves. I guess my question to you is, like, how did you not know you were too early?
Well, it's the spot-on right question, because the joke in venture is early is the same as being wrong, and there have been time after time where we've backed companies that ultimately created big markets but couldn't survive to make it all the way through, and some other company 5 or 10 years later ended up getting the prize, and that was certainly a risk front and center here. The thing that kept resonating with us was Jeff's firsthand understanding as a former CTO, and the stories resonated, but the understanding was real and tangible. You know, he told these stories of when he was the StubHub's founding CTO, trying to communications enable some of their ticketing products and message with their buyers and clients at the time, and having such challenges trying to build a telephony stack or integrate with the existing telephony providers to send an SMS message to someone or to envision enabling a voice call. And so that thesis resonated, and we absolutely bought into this concept that voice enablement and communications enablement was going to be a foundational part of the emerging mobile and internet infrastructure and ecosystem. And so that piece felt real. Then this logical leap of who should provide it was probably the biggest challenge. All these people had massive infrastructure networks and telephony networks that gave them unfair advantages. They should have owned this market. You could throw in there certainly the Ciscos of the world as well, nonetheless, the AT&Ts and Verizons and British Telecoms and all these folks. And for years, we were afraid of them coming into this market. For years, there was these discussions in the board meetings and over drinks with Jeff and the like of, why aren't they coming in and what are they missing? And the beautiful thing is, it's classic innovator's dilemma. And this is why time and time again, our startups kick the crap out of these big incumbents, because they're focused, they're fast, and they're better. And that's what happened here. And it was a bet. It was absolutely a market size and team close your eyes and hope situation. But like, damn it, they executed beautifully.
Can I ask, how do you know, Stay, when you're evaluating companies today, as we both do, how do you know when you're justified in going, oh shit, incumbent X could absolutely build this and they likely will, versus actually we have the benefits of speed, agility, product decision making? How do you know when it's justified versus innovator's dilemma advantage?
I think this is one of the biggest areas where I've softened and mellowed over my time in this industry, when realizing that this notion of an incumbent advantage, I firmly believe now, is an incumbent disadvantage. It is really hard to beat a focused, you know, lean team with their head down going after a problem set. A beautiful example with this is Jeff Lawson, the founder and CEO of Twilio, recently wrote a book. And then Jeff Immelt, the former CEO of General Electric, recently wrote a book. And he's on the Twilio board. boards. We've had these fascinating discussions about it. And Jeff Immelt, one of the awesome, humbling things that he mentions in his book is talking about the digital launch within GE and how he commissioned this massive team and went out to do, you know, make this big statement with, you know, a multi-billion dollar commitment, and it failed. And he says, kind of looking at Twilio and looking at digital transformation and this lean startup mentality, he would have been much better off with a, you know, a one or two pizza team and give 5 or 10 people a budget and a mandate and say, go do it. And then add to the team as they built up versus this whole plug and play instant company mentality of make a big statement. And I've come to believe that in venture. Like, I will take a crack group of hackers that can code like crazy, you know, put them in a room with money and technology and say, run at a big problem. And most of the time, they're going to get there faster than the incumbents. And we're seeing some interesting dynamics now. There's talk of, you know, Apple doing anti-competitive things and some of these folks where they're actually arguably abusing some of their user access and platform access and those things. But I think in open playing fields, which tech overwhelmingly is, the companies that you and I back every day actually have the advantage. And I think very little about incumbent competitors now. I think about other challengers and we focus on those, but the incumbents have completely underwhelmed in their ability to make runs at these pure plays.
So I completely agree with you in terms of the underwhelming performance from the incumbents in terms of competing against the startups. I think the other concern though here, not only that incumbent threat, but it was also the fact that the customers themselves and the developer teams would build on top of Twilio, use it, leverage it, and then with scale, they would actually churn off it. I remember in Algolia's early days, this was the concern with Algolia. How do you think about that initial usage and then churn off with scale?
So this has been an awakening for all of us in the platform as a service and infrastructure as a service arena. And we absolutely did not know how this was going to play out, but it's been a pleasant surprise. I absolutely would put Amazon Web Services in this bucket. In our portfolio, a company like Shopify at $160 billion faced this question all the way up. Twilio at $65 billion, you know, still faces this question at times. It's awesome. And the pleasant surprise there is that if you continue to deliver awesome product and walk people down a rational price curve, you should overwhelmingly be able to keep them. And that, in some ways, it's counterintuitive. AWS saw this, I think, with Dropbox, their IPO, where Dropbox actually did build up a private cloud, take some in-house, cost was part of the justification. But I think it's on public record that Pinterest in our portfolio, certainly one of the largest AWS customers, still uses them and certainly has this conscious trade-off of should I bring it in-house or not, and have chosen, you know, largely not to. And the answer is that third parties usually are better positioned to provide these services. And you're looking for a lot of things, not just price, and the economics need to be rational when you do a build versus buy, but there's all sorts of things around quality of service that just aren't tangible if you're going to build it yourself. And when you think about Twilio building this global low latency network that now comprises hundreds of telephony providers and different business arrangements and different interchange levels, if you are a business just sending SMS to a limited channel in the US, then you have some options and you could absolutely price shop them against wholesalers. And by the way, they'll still be competitive there and they'll be higher quality. But if you want to send to other countries, or if you want to send to other channels, if you want email, if you want video, if you want push in-app notifications, if you start to want to think of this as a communications platform and channel to your customers, then you're going to go with Twilio. You're going to go with the company that's massively invested in the interplay of all these things so that you have a unified customer experience, you have seamless across all these countries, and no one company is positioned to do that for themselves. And that's been the big learning. And so in the end, whereas I think the market and the investors and frankly, even the teams were very worried about this graduation phenomenon, it's happening way less than anyone feared. And it's really just very specific cases where people go narrower, not broader.
I think the most striking case is actually with a Bessemer portfolio company, which is Shopify still using Stripe. I mean, you could not get a better example.
Absolutely. A great example. They're certainly one of Stripe's largest customers, if not the largest. And yet it's a great relationship. And at any point, of course, Shopify could have brought that in-house. They still could in the future. But as long as Stripe continues to be respectful for them economically and provide a great platform, then there's logic in continuing that relationship. And it's a fantastic example at massive, massive scale of how powerful these decisions can be. And another thing that Jeff actually said in his book that completely resonated with me and carries through in my mind from an investment standpoint now is if it touches the customer, that is proprietary. necessary in a tech sense, meaning if it's a UI, if it's part of your product, if it's your app, if it's behind the scenes, if it's plumbing, if it's infrastructure, if it's platform, et cetera, you could make the case that it's not proprietary. So you need the best feeds and speeds and pricing and all that to make it work, but the customer doesn't care what you're using under the covers. And so if I was a CEO today, and when I'm in the boardrooms today with CEOs, my advice is where you can plug in APIs and use them for whatever the capability is, do that first. And over time, constantly look at designing it out, but you almost never will.
Totally agree with you there in terms of the usage of APIs whenever you can. We've spoken a lot about the market in terms of maybe how you got over concerns that others didn't and how you foresaw it. When you look back, are there any areas where you're like, that really surprised me, or I was dead wrong on that? Are there any striking areas within the surprise or wrong element?
Oh boy, absolutely. We could do an entire discussion on those. I certainly have expected video to take off faster than it did. As you think about the Twilio product set, for instance, and all of the channels that we've entered now, I would have thought that voice and SMS would have plateaued earlier and that video would have been this rocket ship. And what you find is that these new channels don't replace each other. So video and push notifications and things, they don't replace SMS. So you don't have this situation where the SMS market plateaus or the email market with the Syncred acquisition, you know, where those plateau. What you find is that they layer on each other and these markets keep expanding. And so voice and SMS are still a massive part of Twilio's business and large growth drivers and expanding internationally, all available from their public records. And really, video has been growing really nicely, but it is still catching up and all sorts of wonderful things happen with the COVID acceleration. Finally, telemedicine took hold and Twilio is a big provider of that. And some of these great consumer use cases are finally taking hold, but it's taken a dang long time. And so the good news is that we've got lots of product in market. We've got great teams executing against these. And so like, let the market decide. But if these were five separate companies and you'd said, you know, bet on two of them or wait your investment, I would have been totally wrong within this Twilio beast. And that's sort of the humbling and refreshing thing all at once is that get products in market and let the market take you there. I'll also say that there's a lot of markets we talked about entering that didn't and probably should have. You know, you mentioned Stripe, which is cloud number one on our private cloud 100 list today with Snowflake's graduation most likely. And we talked a lot about entering adjacent developer services. You know, do you want to be the communications platform and do some things upstack like the marketing cloud and Flex with the SendGrid acquisition, with our Flex launch, with some of those things? Or do we want to be the developer pass of choice with all sorts of API tools? And absolutely billing and payments was one of those discussion areas. And I still believe long-term we made the right decision there, but you could make a case that Twilio should also be Stripe and Adyen right now and should have been a big player in that market.
Totally. And I do see that. You mentioned kind of going up stack, moving down stack and the different kind of elements within the stack. If we think about that with regards to like the customer segments you sell to, you know, again, I spoke to many people on the cap table and one in particular, and it was actually Scott Rainey, I have to say again, we had a great chat by the way. But he said in particular, when did you decide to make the shift to enterprise and how do you advise founders on making this shift today?
Well, first let me give Scott a hat tip because we've been fortunate to work with him and Redpoint in a bunch of deals. And for an investor that's sitting on two of the cloud three right now with Stripe and HashiCorp, certainly I've got a lot to learn still from him as well. But he was a great partner with Twilio. And we worked through this together with the team and with the investors. And this was a ongoing learning. And I'll tell you that we're still figuring it out, which is Twilio has this immensely powerful bottoms-up product-led growth engine that is spectacular. We also, though, want to make sure that they can realize every bit of potential and are greedy. They want to be as big as they can be. And so early on, a lot of these discussions were around, how do we layer in outbound sales? How do we scale up to address, you know, larger use cases? What can we do there? And it was hard and it's been hard, meaning we went through several chief revenue officers who were quite capable and yet couldn't fully crack it. We've gone through several go-to-market motions that each incremental step got us a little further, but didn't fully solve it. And I'll give George Hugh a lot of credit coming over with that Salesforce mentality. He's been in a lot of roles. He's very strategic by background, you know, former management consultant, as well as, you know, marketing and operations and corp dev, biz dev skills. And so he approached it with a solutions mindset. And that's when you go to, you know, ING Bank and say, let's reinvent your call center. Let's think about how do you software enable your call center so you don't have this $100 million monolith with consultants in there every time you want to change something. And let's think about making it nimble and reactive. And that resonated and worked and has been deployed. But furthermore, when you layer in COVID and when businesses were forced to shelter in place and you were dissolving call centers in physical on-prem and scrambling to stand them up, that nimble thinking allowed them to literally turn businesses over in days to fully remote and turn on these flex call centers centers that previously would have taken months or in historical cases even years to implement and make it tangible and drive home that use case. And that's the learning. And I'll tell you, the bottoms-up product-led growth is still the engine of Twilio, but it's been awesome to see them layer on top this other motion and really start to hit their stride with it.
Can I ask one? And it's always a tough one for me and a lot of founders. You mentioned chief revenue officer there. How do you know when's the right time to hire a CRO? And how do you know when it's not working out?
This is definitely the art more than science part of company building. And I saw this both as a CEO of a cloud business myself, and now as an investor in probably 50 of these companies, where each of these is a unique situation. I think the best debate that our CEOs often have with their teams and involve the board in is the level of that first sales executive. And when do you move from founder-led sales to trying to scale up some account executives? When do you layer in a management persona, whether it's a director, a VP, or a CRO to lead sales? And what should the spec be? And I absolutely think that the profile of the person you ultimately hire definitely impacts the seniority that you should slot them in on. Meaning, when you only have a few reps, that person needs to be a player coach. That person needs to be out on sales calls virtually or physically, listening and learning. Like, I don't care how good you are, you do not have it solved if you only have five sales reps. And even if they're all hitting quota, like, you need the learnings, you need the scale up. And so hiring the big company CRO at that point is not only overkill, but it probably sets you up at a disadvantage because they're going to be disconnected. They're going to be layering in other execs. They're going to be working on process when really you need to be tuning the strategy, the pitch, the messages, all of that. And so unique individuals can have the CRO title and do that also, and then quickly scale up to more of the management layered role, but it's not a lot of them. And so typically what I think is the better approach is start with that director, senior director, VP of sales, get it working, get repeatability, scale up the team, go from 2 to 5 to 10, and then build that out. And then over time, in specific cases, that person hopefully can grow into your CRO. And in a lot of cases, you can still bring in someone above them, make them SVP of sales and have a CRO, and everyone wins. And that's a progression that in these hyper growth situations creates opportunity, and you're individual reps become regional managers, they become VPs, your director or VP of sales becomes an SVP of sales or a CRO, and your CRO kicks some butt and maybe becomes president, and you've got a big public company when you wake up a few years later.
You mentioned repeatability there, you mentioned playbook. I always say that before you hire your first head of sales, the founder themselves needs to be the one to develop, to hone, to fine craft that sales playbook before you bring in your head of sales. Do you agree with me, or am I wrong or missing a trick here?
I absolutely agree with the concept. And what I would say is that companies are splitting that out in a few ways now. And we've talked about this notion of product-led growth, which is a very different cycle than the outbound traditional sales motion. And there's a lot in between. But the executive team is absolutely going to be the best position to do that fit, to understand really what is the product market intersection, what's the pull through. And you can't outsource that to your sales team early, or you're going to lose the magic. You're going to lose the insights, and you're going to shoot the rocket off 10 degrees off target, even if it's working. And by the way, part of the challenge with Twilio was that everything was working early on. We had 10 different things we could do. They all look good on paper. So it really was this exercise of how do you prioritize and what do you go after? And we were wrong a lot, but luckily even the wrong answers still sort of worked and you could build on that. Most of our companies aren't that fortunate, and you have to be pretty good at getting really refining the right go-to-market motion. And so in a direct outbound sales motion where you're working with enterprise customers, absolutely when you don't have many customer references and you don't have repeatability, those companies are betting on the team. And they're betting on the CEO or the CRO or the VP of sales or whomever who sits down and says, like, we're going to make this work for you. We will finish this product in a way that makes it successful for you, you know, our sponsor, our buyer. And then what you hope to do is pull your salespeople into those processes over time and work on a gradual handoff. In the product-led growth model, more and more of our founders are product people, or their co-founder is a wizard on the product side, and they're envisioning what the customer wants, and they're building it, and they're letting it be pulled through. And Jeff Lawson, by the way, was very much in that second bucket where he was the prototypical customer. He had been there. He had been the CTO. He said, this is what I would want as an end user, and I'm going to go build it. And I literally remember a meeting in their office early on where he said, I've got all these voicemails queued up of customers calling, like, what do I do with them? And he wasn't being boastful. It wasn't false humility. He was like, literally, in my mind, I don't think I should ever have to answer a phone call because the product should sell itself. They should sign up, whatever. But I've got these really big companies, like Fortune 2000 companies calling saying, I just just want to make sure someone's there. Like, I want to talk to a human before I got our company on this, like, what I do. And so we had this fun discussion, like, okay, like, there's this idea of light sales touch that doesn't mean it's a bad product, doesn't mean you're failing in the product-led growth, but it could be both. And some of those early forays led us down this path of, okay, let's do some, you know, account management so that we can work with our customers, and then ultimately let's layer an outbound sales rhythm to go acquire more of them.
I love that story in terms of the voicemails on Jeff's phone. I do want to touch on Jeff because it's very rare to see a founder really scale and excel at scaling as he has done from founding to IPO and public CEO today. What do you think enabled him to scale so successfully through those stages? And what are the kind of inflection points that you saw in his leadership? I think for me, very much, I see today him being this incredible thought leader as a inspiration almost with his books. He's been very big proponent on like San Francisco itself as a hub, and that's been a big change almost. How do you think about his development and what's allowed him to develop so well?
So I would look at probably his humility and a little bit of a market paranoia as just amazingly positive traits. Almost in the Andy Grove sense of only the paranoid survive, but more importantly, he constantly wants to get better. And he doesn't believe what everyone says about him in the sense of he doesn't let it go to his head. And I'll say that it's really easy to get convinced that you're at the top of the world and you're untouchable and to lose that edge. And he never has. I mean, I remember talking to him the night that he was on the cover of Forbes magazine, and just the whole discussion was, how can I be better? What can I be doing? What else can be there? And I'm like, Jeff, I love you. Just step back and just enjoy the moment. Like, just, you've earned this. You deserve this. Like, the title of the Forbes cover was the world's sexiest stock. Like, they were crushing it. And yet he's constantly saying, how can I be better? And then the sincere part, and I'm glad you brought up like his efforts for San Francisco. We should also mention the Pledge 1% commitment, where not only is he embraced, but he's led and pushed and believes in. Like, he, it sounds straight, but he literally wants to leave the world a better place. I love the fact that he's a multi-billionaire, because I'm convinced that money will go into society and community, and he will have immense impact, and he will invest it like he does the business, where there will be leverage on that. It won't be traditional philanthropy, it will be leverage philanthropy. And I look at Pledge 1%, where he early on came to the board and said, I want to allocate 1% of Twilio's equity, and not in like a marketing way where it's 1% of when we founded it, but like 1% now, immediately pre-IPO, which by the way is now worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and this is what I want to do with it, and hire up a .org team and have impact. When people were fleeing San Francisco during COVID and crapping on the, you know, the city, unfortunately, literally, but also figuratively in terms of leadership and things, he talked to me and a bunch of folks saying, like, look, we got to lock arms. This isn't the time to do the California exodus or the San Francisco exodus or whatever. Like, this city and this state was great for us. We need to return the favor. And he's like, yep, tech is being beaten up, this and that. Like, I don't care. He reached out to London Breed, organized CEOs to come together. He donated quietly, personally. He organized Twilio support very publicly. Like, the community stuff is super real for him. And that's why I love still being on the board today. Like, it's, for me, a source of positive energy. He's an example of how I hope future leaders behave and how they view the platform as not only an opportunity to have a voice, but frankly, kind of a burden, where you need to be responsible about it. And with wealth and success comes that responsibility. And he's an awesome example of what you should do with that power.
I couldn't agree more in terms of kind of with wealth and power comes the responsibility. Speaking of kind of the money element, I do want to touch on the funding itself, because I, again, spoke to many before. Jason Lemkin asked, you know, this was an investment where you doubled and tripled down. He asked, how do you know when to double and triple down on an investment?
This is something we're constantly trying to figure out. And I would say the industry has helped us think through this over the last couple of years. Now, of course, if you look back over the 10 years, the answer is just about any company in the Bessemer portfolio we should have gone all in on, because one, we've been pretty good picking, and two, this market's been fantastic. And the tailwinds here have been glorious, where the scale of outcomes, what used to be a home run at a $500 million for an IPO is now a $50 billion and above IPO. I mean, literally two orders of magnitude bigger than was the home run scenario 10 or 15 years ago. And so it's been tremendously empowering as we at Bessemer think about what does company support look like. And we raised a vehicle that we don't really publicize, but we call Century Fund specifically for this. And it's kind of a riff on the Cloud 100, which we do each year with Forbes and the top 100 private cloud companies, as well as thinking about the iconic companies of the next century and who do we see as those flag bearers for tech and for the community. And our goal is to support our companies all the way through their private life, including through IPO at times. And a lot of times that means supporting outside-led rounds, and we're not sharp-elbowed and piggish. We're not going to box people out if that's the right answer for the company at all. And unfortunately, some firms are doing that more and more, and I don't think that's great for founders. But the flip is, we absolutely will be there to say, hey, this is how we'd invest, this is how we'd approach it, and we're eager to do that. And I think that's part of being a global platform. And I do believe that the world is going to skew to a bimodal curve, where there's going to be super stage stage or regional firms. I put you in that bucket where you are going to be a fantastic early stage European partner for seed stage firms, and we look forward to coming in after and marking your deals up. And then there's going to be global platforms that play multi-stage, multi-sector, multi-geography. And very clearly, Bessemer Venture Partners is in door number two. We have 9 offices around the world, 10 billion plus of capital, and we want to be the best partner for those companies all the way through their journey.
Can I ask a tough one? Is the rise of preemptive rounds from crossover funds, hedge funds, late stage pre-IPO funds, is that not just making life really fucking hard when it comes to that, do I double down or triple down? Because they take it 2 months after you've done it. Byron, I would do a deal 2 months after you've done it. I'm like, if I look at the portfolio, like, odds on, it's going to be a winner. I should pay 2x what you pay.
Thank you for the kind words. And mathematically, I'm happy to say that has proven to be the case where a lot of these funds are coming in and saying, yep, right after, just because Bessemer invested, they'll mark it up the next day 2x if the opportunity is there. And a lot of people are getting spun up on this in the venture world. And hey, you know, that's bad venture and that's unfair and whatever. I view it the total other way. And maybe this is as a former founder. Maybe this is because generally we're early stage investors and we try to get aligned with our founders as early as possible with ownership and cap table. Like, we don't do anything fancy in the cap tables, et cetera. And then it's thinking like a founder or essentially a common holder or a very, very junior preferred holder, which is there's a flood of capital available now. How do we use that strategically to build a business? And how can we be thoughtful and aggressive with that? And I think the flood of downstream capital is an asset if used responsibly. And, you know, everyone loves to beat up SoftBank. They haven't done much in the enterprise cloud world, but I think there's a reason why, which is it's hard to put hundreds of millions of dollars into mid-stage companies. You run the risk of overfunding them, and it's not a paid acquisition game in the way that some of the consumer businesses are. And so it would be irresponsible and probably dangerous. I do think there's certainly that risk with some of these massive funding rounds that the teams start racing in a direction that's slightly off target. And instead of iterating, learning, being startup mentality minded, they get into hyperscale. And that can create some tough situations, especially when the market inevitably hits some air pockets. But with that exception, I'm trying to have the positive view on this, which is very much a let's build something great. Fundings aren't the win. The win is obviously customer wins, but let's be strategic in our financings. And so within our private cloud portfolio right now, I think we have between 25 and 30 unicorns that have obviously chosen to raise, you know, large financings north of a billion. And that's a tremendously powerful asset they have in recruiting and competitive situations and ultimately, I think, in building a big business.
How do you advise founders when preemptive rounds come? A lot say, hey, this has come through. What do you think? Should I take it? And it's often a lot of money at very high prices. How do you advise them? I know it's case dependent, but is there a strain of commonality?
There definitely is. And the overwhelming response is step back, take a breath, and think about this big picture. Absolutely, it's flattering that the round we closed a few weeks ago, someone else will mark it up at double that. But by the way, like, we told you that would happen. You know, that's pretty straightforward. The question is, do you need more money or when do you need money? And in this environment, when multiples are at all-time highs historically, we absolutely want to raise early and be ahead of things. And so this isn't like this pride of, hey, lockdown, we don't need money for 2 years, so don't raise money for 2 years. But increasingly, the answer is somewhere in between, which is raise a half round ahead, not a full round ahead. So this idea of if you can envision deploying more capital and initially we are going to raise this money to get through these phases, let's think about the intermediate milestones where we can then go out and do a positive crazy financing. And by the way, it's going to be even bigger than this current preemptive if it happens. And so trying to just remind people that financing isn't the success. Like, it actually brings dilution. These marks are pretty artificial and don't really go a long way to getting you more customers. And so time and time again, what's happening is our companies are just getting pounded by inbound term sheets. Literally, they keep Google Sheets of all the firms that have pinged them and the unsolicited term sheets that come in. And it's all a game of, okay, let's just keep a level head. Let's build a great business. And then on the early end of the window, when you think you're going to raise, let's do it. Let's hit it hard and let's bring in a great partner. And if this market holds at all, then that's going to lead to great outcomes. But I don't think the rapid stacking of successive rounds and raising 3 financings in a year is ultimately the win in and of itself.
I'm really going for it with this interview. Are you worried about the market shitting the bed? I had a very, very well-known investor the other day tell me, Harry, you don't want to be the person that stops dancing before Mr. Brightside comes on. I'm like, okay. What do you think?
So yes and yes. We published the BVP NASDAQ Emerging Cloud Index. WisdomTree has now licensed it for ETF. It is the definitive basket of cloud stocks to track the industry, the 58 pure play cloud stocks. That was up 100% last year. It was literally the top performing ETF on all of NASDAQ and number two tech ETF, I believe, worldwide. That's a reflection of the power of this industry, but it's also a statement that the average multiple is trading north of 20x revenue, and you look at a Snowflake that's trading at 80 times revenue. That's not sustainable. Now, I can make that statement and also say, I think there's a real good chance these stock prices in absolute sense continue to go up, meaning these companies are growing at north of 40% on the public side, and on the private side, usually growing 80 to 100% plus for the best companies. And so you can absorb some multiple compression and still compound value and be a win for everyone involved. And that's what I think is going to happen. I do think that hopefully we'll have a good year here, that inflation won't go too crazy and the market won't pull back dramatically, but these good times go through cycles and there will be a pullback at some point. I do think we're going to look back wistfully at these cloud multiples and enterprise multiples and even consumer multiples and say, those were the great days to be a founder. At the same time, I think these exits are going to continue to be massive and that we are going to have spectacular category defining companies and that the $1 trillion businesses of the future are still being founded today. And that absolutely, from an investment standpoint, those opportunities remain. And so for a venture capitalist, like, we're not private equity, we're not value folks. I'm still investing. These valuations seem rich and nutty. And at the same time, if I close my eyes and imagine what they can become in 5 to 10 years, I absolutely think they can be bigger and more valuable. And so we're still all in.
I love it. Listen, it's so good to end on a tone of positivity. I want to move into my favorite though, Byron, which is the quick fire round. So I say a short statement, you give me your immediate thoughts, and I've got a really weird first one. Are you ready?
I'm intrigued, but yes.
So I have no idea what to expect from this one, but Jeremy Levine on your team says, can you draw an owl? I don't know where to go.
Oh, that's awesome. That is very Twilio-centric. Twilio has a number of value statements. One of them is draw the owl, which comes from this internet meme, which is how to draw an owl. And it's, you know, step one, draw three circles, the body and the two eyes. Step two, draw the rest of the fucking owl. And it's this idea of like, just figure it out. Like, we're entrepreneurs. Like, we're not going to show you how to draw an owl. Like, figure it out. And I love that mentality. And I'm horrible at drawing an owl in the literal sense, but figuratively, that's very much how we live our lives, which is just dive in and figure it out. You know, execution and operations is the name of the game. And so don't overthink it. And so Twilio constantly talks about their employees like drawing the owl, and don't wait for corporate to have an answer or for infrastructure or whatever. And that's the mentality anyone listening to the show building an early stage business needs to have.
Draw the rest of the fucking owl. I love it. That should be the title of the show.
There we go.
Okay, tell me, what was the pre-mortem for Twilio?
Oh, meaning how did we think they could possibly fail?
Yeah.
The commoditization of communications or the migration of their larger customers. So I think you asked a very insightful question along the way, which I probably didn't give enough due to, which is we worried about that very heavily. And so part of our preemptive solution to that was moving up the stack and making sure that we had the broadest solution with the most interconnectivity and also that we provided software-like capabilities on top so we weren't just dumb pipes.
Okay, this is a tough one. If you were to choose one thing that drove that success, other than Jeff and the founding team, because everyone uses that as a great answer, but it's a nice cop-out. Other than that, what else drove that success? One thing.
Wicked tight product execution. Jeff certainly set the direction here, but constantly it was quality, uptime, and fair price mindset, and ignore a lot of the noise. There were constantly people pounding us of, you should do this, you should do that, all these priorities, all these opportunities. And it was time and time again, you know, we'd open each board meeting with a tweet of customer love. We would show use cases of this is what's working. And it was this mindset, like, if we build a great product, like, the rest will figure itself out. It doesn't always happen, but it happened beautifully here.
Who is the biggest unsung hero from the Twilio team that they did incredible things behind the scenes?
Wow, that list is super long. I mean, the co-founders, John and Evan, were fantastic enablers here. The early team, Oit and Pat on the business side. I mean, Karen and Lee, the community in the group here was just a pleasure to work with. And so, I mean, I could go on. This list should be 50 names long.
It's a completely unfair question for a 20-minute design podcast.
Exactly. That's an ambush, baby. Come on, Eric.
Yeah, that's totally unfair. Tell me, final one, what's your favorite story about working with the company? Many great stories ahead, but when you look back now and this one you've told the most, you tell your kids, what's the one you love the most?
Oh boy. I mean, there are countless long bike rides and dinners and ski outings and whiteboarding sessions. Okay, two tangible ones. I'll cheat. One was Jeff standing outside the NYSE building on Market Street waving the API flag. I literally am looking at the picture right now as I turn my head in my office. I've got it up in my office. Just such a fun, tangible moment of kind of developer empowerment. And then I'll tell you the one which was almost a complete disaster, which was in slow motion in my mind, was Jeff upside down on Woodside Road on a bike, and it was the day before his Forbes photo shoot for what became his first magazine cover story. It was part of the Cloud 100. I love that we were able to help set it up. We were out there just to blow off steam, talk some strategy. He's gotten super fit, lost a bunch of weight, and so this was part of it. And we came up on this intersection, and a car kind of pinched him, and he went off the side of the road and dropped off. There was no shoulder. Hit a bunch of wood chips, and it was like my life flashing before my eyes, but it was, you know, Jeff's rear end in front of me going over his head upside down, and I'm like, oh my god, he's broken bones, he's gonna come up bloody, this is gonna be a mess. And he pops up smiling, not a bruise on his body. He had landed like in this, you know, total dumb luck, like wood chip soft landing, bike was fine, and he gets up and rides on. I'm like, oh my god, this is just awesome. And he laughed it off and went on, but that could have been a disaster. So killing your founder is never a good way to build a business. So let me say that went from disaster to amusement, but I don't think I've ever told that story. So we'll keep that somewhat in the vault.
I absolutely love it. That has to be a heart-wrenching moment. Listen, Byron, thank you so much for doing this. I've absolutely loved it.
Keep up the great work, Harry. Always fun to be with you, my man.
I mean, I just love that show. Byron is always one of my favorites to talk to. If you'd like to see more from Byron, you can, of course, on Twitter at BDita. Likewise, I'd love to see more behind the scenes. You can do so on the 20minutevc.com. But before we leave you today,
question, why can you not invest in sports cards like you can stocks? Well, with Alt, you can. Alt is increasing the transparency and liquidity of alternative assets, allowing you to invest from as little as $7 to $1 million on their exchange. And with Alt, you also save on fees. There's only a 1.5% transaction fee, and they also have this incredible real-time valuation engine, and so you can see what your portfolio is worth in real time. That and so much more. Check them out at onlyalt.com. That's onlyalt.com. And speaking of adding superpowers to your financials, you have to check out Revolut Business. Revolut Business is a financial super app for all things business. It's super easy, powerful, and personalized accounts, gives you control over all your business finances and processes in one place. I'm a proud Revolut Business user myself. So why do I love it so much? Well, joining Revolut Business lets you send and receive money at the interbank rate, no hidden fees, as well as opening accounts in more than 28 currencies. Just incredible. But what I like the most is that you can actually streamline your business processes by integrating all your apps or plugins, like accounting and expenses, and manage it from one place. Basically, you get more control over your day-to-day business finances, processes, and management, which means you can really focus on your actual business goals. I've partnered with Revolut Business to bring you guys an exclusive 2-month paid plan for free, so you can move forward with your business without worrying about your banking provider. Go to revolut.com/20VC to claim your free 2-month trial and get started. But last but by no means least, you might have heard Pilot in the news recently. They just raised $100 million Series C from Sequoia, Bezos Expeditions, and Whale Rock, putting them at a $1.2 billion valuation. Why the buzz? Well, Pilot takes care of your startup's finances for you, from bookkeeping to tax to R&D credits and more. When you work with them, you're paired with a finance expert who's a full-time employee in San Francisco or Nashville who really knows your business from the ground up. Pilot's team works in QuickBooks and NetSuite with software superpowers to help check the work. They've grown with over 1,000 startups like Scale.ai, Lattice, and OpenAI, and no one can help you scale like they can. If you want to let Pilot focus on your financials so you can focus on growing your business, go to pilot.com/20VC and get 20% off the first 6 months of core or select bookkeeping plans. That's pilot.com/20VC.
I cannot thank you enough for your support, and I can't wait to bring you another fantastic episode later this week.